Everybody that can remember what they were doing on August 8th of 1985, raise your hand.
Okay, I see you there in the back row, not raising your hand. I'm Carrie Thompson, and this is, what's the name of this podcast again?
Ever try to remember something, and you can't think of what it is you're trying to remember?
Oh, yeah, playback. We call it playback. It's the only podcast that features NPR stories from 25 years ago. This time around, we've got President Reagan trying to forget about Iran-Contra and the memorable debut of this comedy duo.
It's not frickin' frack, it's click and clack.
Uh-oh.
Come on, get it straight.
The Car Talk guys on the very first broadcast of Weekend Edition Sunday. Plus, bonus audio. Scott Simon interviews sex therapist Dr. Ruth Westheimer.
If there's a problem, go for help. I'm not saying you have a problem.
Thank you very much. You have a way of stopping interviews dead. I have to recover for just a moment.
And now, think back to 1987 and the glory that was Iran-Contra. Now, stay with me on this. You'll find it interesting. Here's Noah Adams.
The President of the United States finds himself the object of criticism about his testimony to the Tower Commission. The commission is looking into the sale of arms to Iran and diversion of funds to the Contras in Nicaragua. President Reagan reportedly changed his story about when he approved arms sales to Iran. The president answered his critics today by saying, "It's possible to forget," NPR's Jim Engel reports.
The president continued to defer any questions on his secret arms sales to Iran until after the Tower Commission issues its report this Thursday. But reporters asked the president during a meeting with black leaders today about longstanding reports that he cannot remember whether he gave his approval for the Israelis to sell arms to Iran in the fall of 1985. The president gave written approval for a more direct American role beginning in January 1986. At first, the president refused to answer the questions, but when asked if he was concerned about reports that he could not remember, he asked reporters a question of his own.
I'm not supposed to answer, but I'd like to ask one question of everybody. Everybody that can remember what they were doing on August 8th of 1985, raise your hand. I think it's possible to forget. Nobody's raised any hands. Okay. All right.
Reports over the last few days have said the president, in his first meeting with the Tower Commission on January 26th, did not dispute the assertion of former National Security Advisor Robert McFarlane. McFarlane has testified that the president gave him a verbal go-ahead for the Israeli shipments. But in a second meeting with the commission on February 11th, Mr. Reagan reportedly said that after talking with White House Chief of Staff Donald Regan, he did not believe that he gave prior approval for the Israeli shipments. Regan has testified that the president did not give his approval beforehand, but did so later. Regan's testimony was based on the absence of any White House documentation indicating presidential approval. Presumably, he also asked the president before testifying on that point before Congress. All along, the contradictions between Regan's testimony and that of Robert McFarlane appear to have been based, among other things, on their own conversations with the president, and the president's inability to remember clearly whether or not he gave the Israelis the green light seems to be the basis for the contradictions and confusion between senior officials on this point. Democratic congressional leaders who came to the White House for a meeting on competitiveness today were also questioned about the president's inability to remember whether he approved Israeli arms sales to Iran. House Speaker Jim Wright was reluctant to talk about it. He said at one point that it was appalling, but also seemed to accept the president's explanation.
I find it believable that someone might have forgotten, and if the president has a lot on his mind, maybe he did forget. I'm not prepared to get into the inner sanctums of the president's mental processes. That's not my purpose.
Dante Fussell, the Democratic chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, also declined to condemn the president for his failure to remember, but suggested that arms sales to Iran was pretty important to forget.
Well, it's difficult, although I must confess I've been to a lot of meetings when I can't remember who was there or what was said. But, it could happen to anybody. So,
what about Reagan?
But that's pretty major.
The White House has argued for many weeks that August 1985 was so long ago that the president cannot be expected to remember exactly what happened. But critics have countered that a reversal of American policy on arms sales to Iran, in part to get American hostages released, is not the kind of thing that fades in one's memory along with more mundane details. I'm Jim Engel at the White House.
Ever try to remember something, and you can't think of what it is you're trying to remember?
Oh, that happens to me all the time.
Does it bother you?
Yeah, sometimes it does, yeah.
It kind of makes me feel edgy. I can't remember. As if somewhere inside the memory section of the brain, there's a huge lost and found filled with the lonely little memories just waiting around to be found again.
Wonder what sort of filing system the brain uses.
Oh, you mean for the memories we forget?
Yeah.
That'd be nice if there was a neat, easy-to-get filing cabinet. You could open a drawer, marked with the date and the time of day or night, and there it'd be in a folder.
Maybe marked happy.
Yeah, that you could open and make yourself happier than larks are supposed to be. Just remembering some little moment you thought you'd forgot.
Well, what about names?
Yeah. All the people we forget that we shouldn't.
Like I'll never forget what's his name.
And there'd be another drawer marked sad.
Folder filled with tears.
And what about bittersweet?
Wonder what's in there.
Oh, a lot of mixed up, happy, sad stuff. Good for whiling away rainy days.
Is there such a thing as total recall?
I don't think so. I don't have it, and there is. And why we remember what we do and forget what we do is a mystery to me.
And what about the filing system?
In the lost and found?
Yeah.
Well, that's probably in the basement of the brain. Cobwebbed by spiders.
Spiders?
Little spiders of our thinking that weave webs.
Webs of what?
Of everything that used to be.
Oh.
The long lost, forgotten memories that just lie there in some strange filing system, gathering time, dust, in the basement of the brain. I go down there every now and then, when I get edgy, and try to find something I'm trying to remember and can't.
Ever find it?
Sometimes, but most of the time I find something else.
Like what?
Some other memory that I'd forgotten and didn't think I was looking for.
Give me a for instance.
Right now?
Yeah.
Well, my almost forgotten father, who's been gone for so long now. Yeah, he loved to practice his cello.
One of the bittersweet memories.
Yeah, bittersweet.
Audio artist Ken Nordine.
Which one of you is Frick and which one of you is Frack?
It's not Frick and Frack, it's Click and Clack.
Oh.
Come on, get it straight.
And in other lives, you are Tom and Ray Malyatsi. There you are, up in Boston at member station WBUR, where on Sunday nights you do the hit radio program in New England. That's what I hear. What's it called? Car Talk?
Car Talk with Click and Clack, the Tappet brothers.
We are indeed really brothers.
Yeah.
And we're car brothers, too. Car blues brothers, whatever you want to call us. And we listen to everyone's car blues.
They phone in questions.
If people have the courage to call us, we will listen to them if they will listen to us. And we hand out hopefully
bad information. People ask us questions.
An occasional insult.
But we have 11 answers, and we sort of sprinkle them around no matter what the question. We have, in the past 10 years that we've been doing the show, we've had 750 questions, and we've only given 11 answers out because they all work.
Okay, well, pick answer number 7 because now...
Answer 7, coming up.
Just a minute. In introducing you to our weekend edition on Sunday audience, we are going to give you a chance, gentlemen, Click and Clack, to demonstrate your skill and what it is that Boston audiences have been enjoying so much for all these years. So hold on, because on the line now is a car question for the car guys. This is John Harrison up in your area of Boston. Mr. Harrison?
Yes.
Hi, go ahead.
Okay,
hi,
thank
John.
You. I just bought a new Americorps, and this is the first turbo engine I've ever owned and first fuel-injected engine I've ever owned. And I didn't know if there's anything special I should do about it in its care and feeding. There's sort of religions seem to be spurting up about how often to change the oil and whether you should use 10W30 or 10W40 or whatever.
As far as care and feeding, two things. Number one, you should probably make sure you always use the right oil. There are various oils that are specifically designed for turbos.
Okay.
And it should say so on the container.
Oh, really?
Okay. Or it should at least have the rating that's specified in your owner's book.
Uh-huh.
It'll usually be an SFCC rating.
So I shouldn't use the generic stuff with the UPC label on the sign.
No, I mean, you know, I wouldn't buy the stuff that says just oil on the can.
Like Wesson oil and stuff.
Right.
That's not good.
No, you've got to use the highest quality
gentlemen,
oil, and frequent oil changes are in
gentlemen,
order.
Gentlemen, what is this UVPICQX? What are you yammering away about there?
That's technical lingo,
oh,
Susan.
Oh,
that,
you, What?
Women can't understand.
Oh, I've been waiting for you.
Hit him, Susan.
I've been waiting for that. Now, come on. What's the IP?
Code words.
Yeah. Secret code words. You have to have your decoder book.
That's right. This is all CIA stuff.
What the letters signify is ratings put on the oil by the Society of Automotive Engineers in terms of its ability to absorb contamination, its ability to absorb acids, neutralize them, its ability to hold contamination in suspension, et cetera, et cetera.
Right, and in terms of the viscosity of the oil...
Yeah, I was waiting. I'm thrilled. Say it again. I was waiting for that word.
Viscosity.
Oh, yes, viscosity.
The mushiness,
the mushy
we call
part, right. What about the viscosity?
Those were the 10W30 and 10W40 numbers that John mentioned.
Those sound like tax forms.
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
Viscosity's rather provocative.
I can tell you're catching on to this, Susan.
did he answer your question?
Well, pretty much on the oil side, should I just follow the manufacturer's recommendations on changing periods? Or
I would
or
probably
I
change
it
twice
or?
As twice as often as they recommend.
Okay.
They probably recommend a change every 7,500. I would change it every 3 to 4.
Uh-huh.
And moreover, just as a general rule of thumb with any turbo-powered car, mm-hmm. I would deploy the turbo as infrequently as possible.
That's why I bought it, to put the boots to it now and then.
Well, obviously. And when you do that, you'll notice that the car really does respond.
Oh, you bet.
The fact is that every time you deploy the turbo, number one, you're wearing it out. Mm-hmm. And number two, you're wearing the engine out more.
Uh-huh.
There's no question about
that. It
puts
a tremendous load on the engine, and you will pay for all the fun you have. Not only do you pay when you buy the car with a turbo,
right.
But you will pay later in repairs, because if you really want to put the boots to it, as you say, mm-hmm. then you're going to wear out the engine much, much faster. But what do you care? You bought the car to have fun.
But the turbo's guaranteed for 50,000 miles, isn't that correct?
Yeah, that's right. They have an extended warranty on it.
I would drive the blazes out of it for the first 50K, and maybe you'll cook it, and
go
give you a new one.
And John
and
Harrison,
trade it in when you get sick of it.
John Harrison, when you do that driving, stay away from my house, will you?
No,
thanks
a
million. Listen, thanks for, yeah, good.
Buy a radar detector.
Thanks for your question, and thanks to you two Malyatsis for giving all of this sympathetic attention and all the alphabet soup and the stuff and the things and the viscosity. Yours in good viscosity. Till next time, gentlemen. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
And now, Noah Adams interviews a very young member of the NPR demographic.
Betsy, tell me your full name, please.
Betsy Allison Walter.
Betsy Allison Walter, and you're 8 years old?
Almost 9.
And you live in Manhattan?
Mm-hmm.
And you're in our studio in New York. I appreciate you taking some time to come in and telling us this story. You wrote a letter to the mayor of New York, Mayor Koch.
Right.
Tell me about that, please.
Well, I wrote to him because my parents are getting divorced, and I really don't know who to turn to. And I just told him that my parents are getting divorced, and my dad is with somebody else, and I was just getting used to something, and now this, and it's really kind of hard on me, and I like an opinion.
Why did you write to Mayor Koch?
Because he's somebody who I've thought he's very good to us, I guess, because he's the mayor and he knows a lot of things, and I thought he would know about this, too.
Yeah. Did you get an answer back?
Yes.
What did he say?
He, it's very short. Thank you for the letter. I was saddened to learn of the difficult times you are experiencing now. It is important for you to share your feelings and thoughts with someone during this time. I wish there was an easy solution to these problems, but there is not. Please remember that you are loved and that people care about you. All the best. Sincerely, Edward Koch. Hmm.
Was that reassuring to you in a way?
No.
No? Did you have any thought in your mind that perhaps he could actually do something about it? For example, call your father and get your mom and dad back together?
No.
No, you just wanted some advice.
But see, I tried it sometimes, like, because I had a dance recital one day, and I invited them both, but I wanted them to sit next to each other, but they didn't.
Yeah. What other advice have you been able to come across, to find?
Well, the guidance counselor, she said that a lot of kids have the same problem. Say, there are 400 in school, say, and like 300 of them have the same problem.
Sure. Sure. You know, most people you talk with will have had parents who were divorced.
Oh.
Yeah, most people.
It's kind of a sad thing, but most people get through it all right, too. That's my advice for you.
Thank you.
You wrote another letter to somebody who had written a book called The Boys and Girls Book of Divorce?
Yes.
A psychologist?
Mm-hmm.
And what did that person tell you?
Well, he said that I should try another of his books to find out help.
Oh, he wanted you to go out and buy his book, did you?
Well, we had the one he recommended.
And how did that go? What did you think of that one?
Well, the problem is, he puts things in a way that I can't really quite get it through me, that I already know, and I want some real advice that my questions really are, not just answers that people keep telling me over and over again.
Can you give me an example, Betsy?
Why'd they get divorced? What happened?
Do you think that parents sometimes don't think children are old enough to understand or can't handle it and so will hide some information?
Yes.
Not that they have to say everything, but you think there ought to be a little bit more sharing of the information?
Yeah, that's what my mom said.
Yeah. And in terms of their own divorce, do you understand it better now?
No.
No? Why? What still don't you understand about that?
Well, why did they have to go off and do it? Because, see, the most painful part is when I saw my dad packing up and I really don't understand because, like, it's hard because they won't tell me what happened to them and I really want them back together and I don't understand why they can't.
Yeah. What do you think you've learned from this? Do you think if somebody else in school, for example, told you that their parents were getting divorced, how do you think you could advise them?
Well, I wrote a book and I think I would say the same information that I said.
You wrote a very small book?
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you have it there?
Mm-hmm.
Could you read some of it for me, please?
All right. Let me get it. It's called A Book About Divorce. Should I read the whole book? It's short.
Sure.
It's not your fault when your parents get divorced. Why does it have to be you? Because Mommy and Daddy don't love each other anymore. Remember, it's okay to be sad and cry. Tell someone about your feelings. That's it.
That's nice. Listen, Betsy, thank you for talking with us. I appreciate it, and I wish you the best. I hope things go well for you.
Thank you.
And maybe this is the beginning of a writing experience for you, and you can grow up to be a writer.
I don't want to, but I want to write, like one book that would make it, but not a whole series, you know?
You just want to write a book and make a lot of money?
No, not money, just famous.
Oh, okay. Okay. Okay, Betsy, thank you. Good night.
Okay, good night.
That story was produced by a young Ira Glass in 1987. Betsy Walter's story stayed with him. In 2007, Ira asked Noah Adams to interview Betsy again.
You're in the studio with us now. Tell us your name.
Betsy Allison Walter.
How old are you?
I just turned 29.
And you're working?
I am. I have been a elementary school teacher for the past 7 years.
How many times over the years do you think you've heard this taped interview?
Probably 12, a dozen. Because I didn't hear it for a while. I think I heard it again when I was about 22, 23. Every time I've had a boyfriend, I've played it for him.
And each time it's got to be different. How's it been changing for you?
Yeah, recently was the first change.
Really?
I used to only hear it with my exact inner monologue from when I was there in the studio. And when I heard certain things, I can still remember the exact thoughts running through my head. I remember it very clearly. I remember thinking that you were just another grown-up, you know, offering your advice. All these grown-ups kept telling me things, but I felt like I knew what they were going to say. They're going to say, it'll be okay, and people fall out of love, but that wasn't what I wanted to hear. Like, it's just, I remember the everything. It was, I don't know how. And then recently, I think it was probably when I graduated college when I heard it again. I heard it as an adult, and it was so heartbreaking. I didn't think it was sad when it was me. It was just what was going on. And it made me sad to hear pain in my voice, confusion. And now I hear it even differently as an educator.
And looking back at that moment, did you really want the truth? Or did you want things to be well again and whole again and...
I don't believe that I wanted what the truth really was, but I wanted what I had created the truth to be in my head. I wanted them to say something to the fact that, you know, oh, we just needed time apart and of course we'll come back together. I wanted what I thought the truth was. If I had heard the real truth, I think that it would have been devastating.
Your dad was fooling around?
Mm-hmm. And my mom did an amazing job of never, ever putting any blame on him, of always being supportive of us having a relationship. But if she had said the truth, I couldn't have a relationship with him. I would have been too angry.
Okay, let's imagine this. Your advice just to that 8-year-old Betsy, who was you?
I do grapple with this. It's hard because I know exactly what I wanted to hear when I was 8. I think I would tell her that, you know what, I would actually say, this is probably how your life is going to be. You know, your parents made this choice for you. And now, instead of questioning and wondering for so long why this choice was made, how are you going to live your life now knowing this is your life? I think I still know myself, and I would have been persistent wanting answers regardless, but I do think that I needed to feel less helpless.
Baby, can you hear me now? The chains are locked and tied around my door. And baby, will you say,
and speaking of issues, here Scott Simon chats with sex therapist Dr. Ruth Westheimer.
No, I don't want to begin with sex with you.
I should hope.
Well,
I should hope not on the air like this on your famous radio station.
You haven't disappointed me at all. I'd like to begin by talking about films, okay?
Of course.
You've seen this film how many times?
To tell you the absolute truth, yesterday was the 11th time. And I have to tell you, Scott, that I probably will see it a few more times. I love sitting there and seeing this film that I not only played in, but really enjoyed doing very much.
You know, I think in this country, we perceive the French as being a little bit more sexually oriented, let's say, than we are in our own culture.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything to that?
You see, I lived in France for many years as a student, and I am super careful not to continue a myth. I do not believe that a Frenchman or an Italian or a Latin from Spain or any of the other cultures, that they are better lovers. Not so. I do believe it depends on the personality of those two people. Now, it is true, when you walk in Paris, maybe the French women do dress more seductively. Maybe they walk a little differently, more seductively. But when it comes to actual sexual functioning, from the vast experience that I now have by people telling me their innermost bedroom secrets, I think that Americans have nothing to be embarrassed about.
Well, this is good news. You know, one of the things, to my mind, nicely, that you've brought into American culture is the fact of not only discussing sex openly, but with a smile. But, you know, it seems so many stories that we've done on this program and others over the past year have introduced the idea that sex can also be treacherous.
Yes, because, you know, you and I and everybody else, including the French, come from a tradition where these matters have not been discussed. Mm-hmm. A Victorian Puritan tradition. And when sexuality is used either as a power play or is used to get some advantage from somebody, I would think that especially in a city like Washington, that might be the case at times, then it's very sad. And the other aspect for everyday occurrences is when it becomes boring. That's the worst. Because sexual life that is not cherished and that is not cultivated and is not taken care of dies. So that part, I would say, even thinking about this movie, that this little sensuousness that you feel, even between Gérard Depardieu and a sculpture, when he talks to that sculpture, when he dreams and imagines her lovers and whatever has happened to her in previous years, that's sensuality, and that's something that we have to cultivate.
You know, because of the dread of disease that I think some people are developing because of AIDS, there's a real fear, there seems to be, of sex.
Now, first of all, Scott, this dreadful disease of AIDS has to be taken very seriously, and we must find a cure. Money has to be appropriated in order to find a cure. I do not waste a split second of my professional or private life in blaming one group or the other, because that's useless. We have a dreadful disease. We need a cure. I do say to people to be careful. I never talk about safe sex. I do not think there is such a thing, because we don't know enough about it. I do say, no question about it, that using a condom would provide safer sex. And I do believe that on public radio, on my program, Sexually Speaking, across the country, on the television program Ask Dr. Ruth, I do speak out loud and clearly that condoms must be available.
With advertising now being accepted increasingly by television and radio stations for condoms, has anybody approached you to endorse a line of condoms?
Well, I would never. First of all, I did do a commercial for condoms for a particular mark. I would never say one mark is better than another, ever. I did do a commercial for the Armed Forces Network. And I do say to our soldiers, you who protect us, make sure you protect yourself.
Oh, that's a very good line.
But, and I would do any commercial that I would be asked to do, but I would never say this one is better. But I do believe that somebody like you, Scott, who has, I'm very serious, who has what you are in sociological terms, you have an obligation as a significant other to talk about condoms on the air. In a public service spirit, we have an obligation to talk about condoms. We also have an obligation, Scott, to say that, God forbid, any woman that would be in your arms should fake sexual satisfaction.
I'm having a hard time. Why do you say God forbid, doctor? Is the idea so improbable that a woman would be in my arms? Or
no, I'm saying that women should not fake. You see, when I talk about condoms and the other dreadful aspects, I do not want to forget that sex is fun, that sex is what makes a movie go around, that sex is pleasurable, and that that message has to get across that if there's a problem, go for help. I'm not saying you have a problem.
Thank you very much. You have a way of stopping interviews dead. I have to recover for just a moment. You know, I want to ask you this. Because of a Supreme Court decision last year, certain forms of private sexual conduct have become, in certain states, illegal. How do you feel about that?
I feel very bad about that, Scott. Anything that two consenting adults do in the privacy of their bedroom, living room, kitchen floor, studio of a radio station, is in the privacy, I did say, has to be their business. And specifically about homosexuality, since we do not know, as you know, Scott, the etiology of homosexuality, we do not know why some people are attracted to members of their own sex. In the privacy of people's homes, with the respect that we have to give to any human being. And so these kind of laws and rules and regulations are just a waste of time.
Okay, thanks very much.
Thanks for playing along with us at home. Next month, we'll bring you a classic from the NPR archives, Ira Glass explores the misunderstood song lyrics that stick in your head.
My friend Susan was convinced for the longest time that Mick Jagger did a song. She was thinking of the song Beast of Burden. She thought the lyrics were, "Never leave your pizza burning."
Well, it's I'm so hot for you, but Dad always thought it was I'm so affable, because it makes sense. I'm so affable, but you're so cold.
And Scott Simon spends a day with the National Guard. I'm Carrie Thompson, and you're listening to Playback.